This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Paris has leaders from around the world discussing how to prevent climate change. They say this is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, threat to our world today. They want to prevent global temperatures from rising, which mostly means taking steps to move away from fossil fuel energy and toward clean energy. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Robert Morley about which countries are going to have the toughest time with the results of this conference, with the determinations that the members of this conference make. It looks like Germany has decided to send its military into Syria to help in the fight against the Islamic State there. This is part of a strong trend in recent years where Germany is engaging the world militarily in a way that it was long unwilling to do after World War II. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the significance of this latest decision, what prompted it, and how it fits into the historical trend of German militarism. Is your heart older than you are? A new study estimates that 3 out of 4 American adults have a predicted heart age older than their chronological age, putting them at greater risk for heart problems like a heart attack or a stroke. We're going to talk with nutritionist and fitness coach Jörg Mardian about this study, and we're going to see what you can do to actually reverse this trend in your own heart. You can actually make your heart younger. And finally, we'll finish the program by examining the often immoral and sometimes unintelligible lyrics of the current top pop hits. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Leaders from all over the world have converged on Paris for 2 weeks of talk on climate change. Some may consider it ironic that they're talking about climate change as the biggest threat in the world in the aftermath of terrorist attacks in Paris, the very city they're meeting, from the Islamic State, which is storming across the Middle East, and that Europe is dealing with a refugee crisis from Syria, where 250,000 people have died in a civil war over the past 5 years. But still, these leaders want to craft a new international agreement to reduce greenhouse gases beyond 2020. That's when the 1997 Kyoto Protocol expires. They want to prevent global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times. I have Trumpet writer Robert Morley here with me to talk about this. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good to be here.
So you basically say this is not actually, for a lot of these people, it's not really about the environment as much as it's about money and power. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, absolutely it is. I think for the people, most people that go out in the streets protesting, you see protesters in San Francisco over climate talks in California and elsewhere. A lot of those people on the street, yeah, this is about saving the planet. To them, this is about this problem that they see, a global warming. But when you take it to the political level, when you take it to the international level, at that stage, it stops being about this moral good, because at that level, geopolitics is always about money and power. And it's no different with this situation. When you look at what's going on, when you look at the money that's involved with the negotiations that are going on in the Paris, the current Paris climate talks, this is not primarily about stopping global warming. This is about which nation is going to gain, who's going to be the winners from these talks, and who's going to be the losers from these talks.
Now, you're being awfully cynical here, Robert. isn't it possible? This is one issue that faces us all, and they're coming together to try to, you know, create a common solution to this common problem.
Well, come on. We all know politicians use ideologies to motivate their base. This happens, it's no more clear than in the United States between Republicans and Democrats. This is about who is going to come out of this with more motivated voters, and who can impact and eliminate and cause most damage to the fundraising of one side or the other. That's clearly what this is about. In the United States, we've seen the coal industry recently just being decimated by these new proposals for carbon dioxide emissions. And we're seeing that, you know, maybe I am sounding a little cynical here, but the impacts of these negotiations, if President Obama is to get his way, will destroy the fossil fuel industry. And the fossil fuel industry is a big supporter of Republicans, generally speaking, in the United States.
Okay, so this is a scorched earth policy then, because I saw a poll recently that said that among Americans, 3% of the people, this was a Fox News poll, I think they asked about 1,000 people, 3% said the top problem in the world facing the world today is global warming or climate change. Among Democrats, it was 6%. I mean, a very small number of Americans say this should be the top concern. And the president seems to be determined to make these policy changes, to commit this a huge amount of money. What did he say? $51 billion, something like that, to this cause, regardless of what the American people think. He's not going for votes.
Yeah, well, he might not be going for votes, but he's going for money, and he's going for who wins in the world of media and big media. Who's going to score the most points against each other? I think there is that element too. But $51 billion, I mean, that's peanuts, but that's just a time. If you start totaling up the costs involved from these proposals in these climate talks. Now, mind you, most politicians saying, even President Obama is saying that he's not committing America to
$51 million. I got to get that right. Okay.
51. I mean, that is so tiny. And $51 billion is even tiny compared to what's needed. Scientists out there are talking about what it would take America to reach these goals where we can stop global warming, stop it by 2050. And if we're to stop the warming that they say is taking place by reducing our carbon emissions, one of the high profile plans calls for America building 450,000 windmills across the United States. Let me put this in context for you. Over the past 20 years, Europe, which is a leader in green energy, has built about 3,000 windmills in Europe. So here, to get America off of fossil fuels, which is the goal of this, this is the goal of the far left, those who are pushing this climate change agenda, or stopping climate change's agenda, they want America to be fossil fuel free. That's the end goal. And to do it is going to cost trillions and trillions of dollars. So we better be right about this. First of all, we better be right that carbon dioxide, what you and I exhale when we breathe, what plants take in to use to grow, is basically fertilizer for them, that this is causing a catastrophic threat to this world. And it better be an imminent threat, because as you said at the top, there are a lot of very, very dangerous things going on in this world that seem to me that would be a much more higher priority on the world's leaders list. How about the war, like you mentioned, in Syria? How about nuclear weapons being around the world? How about, I mean, the list can go on and on. How about some of these pandemics and antibacterial resistant diseases and things like that? I mean, when you start looking at some of the challenges this world faces, this climate change, which may or may not be caused by humans, it seems like it's a little blown out of proportion.
Okay, so there they are making decisions and trying to figure out how to prevent this problem, which they are assuming is imminent and it is catastrophic and it does need to be dealt with immediately. Any idea on who wins and who loses coming out of these talks?
Yeah, well, absolutely. If you look at nations of this world right now, America is just in such an enviable position in terms of energy resources. America has the most inexpensive energy and abundant energy in the world. There's not another nation that compares to it. We have oil prices today, less than $40 a barrel. We have record low natural gas prices. We have coal reserves in the United States, unlike any nation in the world. And that has given U.S. industry incredible benefits. Energy costs are the lowest in the world for them. That makes our products lower than anywhere else in the world. And that gives American businesses a leg up on the competition. So coming out of these talks, if we're to arrive with a deal that limits America's ability to use those fossil fuels and has to start adopting more expensive clean energy, windmills and solar panel and all the rest, well, basically, America will be the country that takes the biggest hit from that because, for example, the Europeans, they import all their oil, they import their natural gas, and they're paying high prices for it, much higher than America does. So when they're not only are they paying high energy costs in Europe, they're also sending that money overseas to other nations. So that's a pretty big hit to their economy. So for them to switch from one high-cost energy source to another high-cost energy source, it's kind of a wash for them. It might even be a benefit because now they're buying German windmills instead of sending money to Saudi Arabia for the oil. So it's a benefit for them. But here in America, that money from our energy industry, that stays in America. We're sending When we're buying oil, we're buying American oil. It stays within the country. Now we switch to windmills where we're buying German windmills, or we're buying Chinese solar panels, which the vast majority of the solar panels in this world come from China. So when we look, when we add up the winners and losers from any hypothetical transition that are, you know, these regulations that may be coming out of this, we're going to see, relatively speaking, America would take probably the biggest hit in the world. Now, I think all nations would be losers in the short term. I mean, it's going to cost an incredible amount of money. We're shutting down perfectly good coal and natural gas plants or other power generating facilities and spending money to put up new ones. So everybody in that sense, from an economic perspective, is a loser. But the question is, who loses the most? And by far, it's America.
It's almost as if the American economic model requires the kind of cheap energy production that we have, and the free market economy, it tends to basically reach for these kinds of energy sources, and we have the flexibility within the system to be able to harness those power, those energies, and to use those even where maybe they are environmentally destructive or where there are problems associated with them. The free market doesn't really care, but it's almost like this system and the free market system and the capitalistic system is going to face a real challenge if those are removed, if we no longer have access to that kind of energy.
Well, absolutely. And I think that this is something that people are a little bit ignorant of. Much of this movement to limit carbon dioxide, these protesters, these environmentalists, they do want to take America to the stage where there is no fossil fuels being used. And that is going to have profound impacts on not only our way of life and our standard of living, but much of this movement is an attack on capitalism itself. If you look at what these protesters are saying, if you watch these protesters out there and some of the signs they're carrying, you know that they view capitalism as the problem for climate change. And even Pope Francis has come out and he's talked about that. And he's made the link between capitalism and global warming. And for many people behind this movement, the movers and shakers behind this movement, they see capitalism as the problem. And capitalism must be defeated if we're to quote unquote, save the world from global warming.
So you say everybody loses in the short term, but some nations lose less. And you're basically talking about this as if it is aimed at everybody gets knocked down a peg, but the United States gets knocked down the most. And we get something closer to parity among nations once that happens.
Oh, the Europeans would love a more level playing field. I mean, American industry has a great advantage over the Europeans, over many of these nations that don't have the natural resources that we do in America. But, you know, there's going to be other losers too. Think of the African, all these developing world nations. I mean, India has voiced great concerns at this meeting because basically the world's telling them, you can't build power plants anymore that use coal. And they're saying, well, that's the only way we can provide electricity, that we can afford to provide electricity for our people. We'd rather have our people, 200 million people in India, living without electricity, because that's what's going to happen if we can't use the resources that we have here in our country. And that's the other half of these climate talks, is trying to figure out how is the world going to pay for this. And what's coming about, and what we're hearing, is that the developed Western world is being pressured, particularly America and some of the Western Europeans, to provide money and funds and to pay for these developing nations like China and India to embrace new technologies.
So not only would we have to pay for transition to more expensive fuel in our countries, we would also have to pay for
China's transition and India's transition and all these other nations. And we're not being told that, but if we think our taxes are high now, let's start talking about paying for power plants in Bangladesh and all over the place. I mean, we do want these people to have access to the same sorts of things we do here in the United States. There's nothing wrong with that. But the question is, you know, who should pay for it?
The nations that you're talking about, say the lesser developed nations, they're not the ones that are producing the carbon problems, the emissions that is so concerning to these to the people who are expounding these theories, right?
Well, a lot of them aren't, but that's the thing. Many of these nations are becoming more Western in terms of their consumption, in terms of their electricity usage, power usage. Their automobiles are being sold in these countries now. So their carbon, you know, the carbon dioxide they're producing, their carbon footprints are increasing dramatically. And they're looking at the West and saying, hey, you guys cut down all your trees to industrialize. You guys built all these power plants so your people can have electricity and air conditioning and heating, central heating and all these things. We want that too. And now you're telling us that we can't do that. Okay, fair enough. But you pay for us to build the windmills and you pay for us to put up the solar panels.
It's interesting to have this discussion in absence of a clear technology to replace these. It seems like everything that we're talking about, wind, solar, hydroelectric, that all of them are developing, and none of them is just a home run hit for a replacement technology, that all of them have their downside. And even when you talk about production of 450,000 windmills, where do you get the energy to produce those? Just a lot of question marks, good intentions, but are we really looking at solutions to the problems on the scale of what we're concerned about?
Right. Great question. And that is one of the questions out there in the environmental field right now is, do we have the solutions? And I think most scientists out there, advocates would say, yes, it's a matter of will. If you look at solar panels, for example, costs for solar panels have come down 80% in the last 5 years. Economy of scales have kicked in and China is just pumping out solar panels. So advocates take a look at that and say, hey, look what we can do with technology when we really put our hearts into it. There's always a cost for that. There's always the alternative. What could the money have been spent on alternatively? But there's also challenges with solar power. The sun only shines for half the, for so many hours of the day. When you get to the northern climates, the intensity of the sun because of the tilt of the earth is not there. So you don't produce. So there's problems with all these. What happens when the wind isn't blowing? Our electrical grids aren't designed to take intermittent surges when, the wind's blowing and it isn't blowing. Now, these are all challenges that are being overcome. But as you said, there is no, one-size-fits-all solution out there. And I don't think the scientists out there are saying that there is a one-size-fits-all solution either. But they are saying that vast resources need to be harnessed to make this transition.
Well, interesting stuff. We'll keep our eye on the conclusions that come out of this conference. We're talking to trumpet writer Robert Morley. He's written an article called The Climate Summit is About Money and Power. Working on it now. It's likely going to go up on thetrumpet.com this Thursday. You can watch for it there. Thanks for your time, Robert.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the wake of the November 13th terrorist attacks in Paris, the Trumpet is really watching Germany closely and its reaction to these attacks. This week, Germany decided to send its military into Syria to help the fight against the Islamic State there. Germany already provides weapons and training for Kurds fighting against the Islamic State in Iraq. But now it's going to head into Syria with reconnaissance aircraft, tanker planes, a warship. It's also going to provide satellite surveillance. It's going to be working together with France in this fight. I have trumpet writer Richard Palmer on Skype from our UK office. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us more about this decision by Germany's cabinet this week?
Yes. So on Tuesday, Germany's cabinet approved or agreed on what they want. It's pretty much exactly as you said, the mission that they'll or the mandate they'll request from the Bundestag, from the German parliament, will be approval for a mission for up to 1,200 soldiers. So that's quite a significant deployment for the Bundeswehr at the moment. Just to give it, just by comparison, they've got just under 1,000 troops in Afghanistan, around 700 in Kosovo. They're not actually going to be sending 1,200 troops over there, but it will be one of their bigger deployments currently. But what I think is most significant about this is the speed at which they came to this decision. Just by way of comparison, if we go back to one of Germany's previous fairly large-scale military missions in Mali, on the 20th of December 2012, Mali requested help. By mid-January, around January 13th, 14th, French help was arriving. French planes were bombing bombing targets. They had soldiers landing in Mali. Towards the end of January, Germany sends transport aircraft, and it wasn't until February 28th that Germany approves a military mission for up to 330 soldiers. So back then, this whole process of doing all of these negotiations, working out the deals with the different parties, drumming up public support, etc., took over 2 months between the request for help and the troops arriving. Compare that to this time, and the timescale is much more like 2 weeks. By the Bundestag will probably approve this on Friday, so it will be 3 weeks to the day after the Paris attacks. And we're also talking about a much larger mission, up to 1,200 troops compared to up to 330. So I think that tells you a lot about how the political climate has changed in Germany towards military missions. It's much easier to get all the different parties to agree. It's much easier to get through all that coalition politics. It's drumming up public support is no longer a very big deal. So it shows a big shift in Germany's willingness to make military deployments.
The big change being Paris.
Paris, and there's evidence that there were shifts in German public opinion going on well before Paris. Even before Paris, there was a survey that came out that found that in the first time in the history of doing this survey, a majority of Germans wanted to increase military spending. It found that 66% of Germans said that Germany needed to be doing more to solve international crises. And again, that was the highest level ever since the survey began. So there's a major shift just within the past few years that's been going on in German public opinion. And the Paris attacks have only intensified that.
You say years. I wonder how much the immigration crisis, which is really something that kind of blew up just within the last few months, has intensified Germans' recognition of the need to intervene abroad. If they're looking at, say, Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East as being the incubators of these problems that are driving all of these people over to Europe and flooding European nations with people who are fleeing, they say, well, let's check this problem at its source. You also had the immigrants that were coming across the Mediterranean and the issues that I guess that goes back maybe a little bit further. But they're recognizing we can't just sit back and let these problems come to us. We've got to go check them at their source.
Absolutely. I you're right. I did say years. Really, the vast majority of the change is within the past 12 months. There was some, going back even to last year, there was still some increase in German support for military spending, German support for getting involved militarily abroad. But it was nowhere near as dramatic as the increase over the past year. And actually, when you look at how safe or unsafe Germans are feeling, there's been a very dramatic change in that over the past year. So, for example, this same survey found 1 year ago that only 6% of Germans said that they felt very unsafe, or rather uncertain about the security situation in Germany. So only 6%. Now, this year, they found 23%. Said that. So there's a huge increase in the number of people feeling like they're not very safe. And you look at what's the big thing that's changed within the past 12 months, the only thing I can really think of that could cause that change would be the migrant crisis.
It's just interesting to look at this in terms, you talk about the speed, the change in speed between, say, the Mali situation and this situation, a deployment that would be, it looks like to be four times as large and taking place over a period of about one third as much time. So you can see the intensification of Germany's resolve to deal with these things. And you just wonder, it seems like every time there's a major crisis like the terrorist attacks, 11/13 attacks in Paris, that there's a real strong urge to do something and do something now. And then it kind of tapers off. You saw a certain amount of resolution after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, but then it tapers off. But then the next time it's more, and the next time it's more intense. And, you know, well, we should have done even more about it. We're not going to make that mistake this time. So there's this ramping up of intensity in European response that we're seeing. And maybe this is just a point on a graph that leads to who knows where the next time.
Yes, absolutely. But then I think the other thing is, when it tapers off, it doesn't necessarily taper off all the way. And in fact, in some cases, we've seen in recent years, it doesn't. You get the crisis, and then it doesn't taper off at all afterwards. For example, I mentioned at the start, there are still nearly 1,000 German soldiers in Afghanistan. That I mean, we wrote about this back after the 9/11 attacks and America went into Afghanistan. Germany going into Afghanistan, that was a big move. That was a huge milestone in Germany's military development. And things have tapered off, but there are still nearly 1,000 troops there. And Britain has gone home. Most of the other countries that were involved in Afghanistan have packed up and gone home now. Germany's still there with a very significant troop presence. And then Mali, you know, the crisis, you had the big crisis in Mali. And actually, instead of tapering off in Mali, German deployment has just gone up and up and up. So they're still involved there. And then on this particular crisis, here's what the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, told the Bild. He said, we're going to have to take a long breath before we beat an enemy like IS, like Islamic State. And he told Bild that it's going to be a long process. So the way the German politicians aren't selling this as a short-term quick fix, we're going to send in 1,000 troops, get in there, get out. The mandate is approved only for 1 year. That's fairly typical. It'll probably be renewed. But the way they're talking is that Germany needs a long-term presence in and around Syria to deal with this threat. So there's still, even though it tapers back, people relax, with every step, Germany remains more engaged in the world. And really, this deployment, it's going to have to have some long-term impacts on the German military. One thing we've talked about at the Trumpet website a bit is the German military has been having major problems in recent years with just equipment readiness, the availability of spare parts, things not being in a good state of repair, having mothballed too many pieces of equipment. And already the changes that they've been and the deployments and the increased pace of military deployments over the past couple of years from Germany has really forced them to bear down on this problem. They're spending billions on trying to fix this now. And so just another major military deployment of 1,000 plus is only going to increase the pressure on Germany to get that sorted out. And as we've spoken on this program, they're getting more tanks out of storage. They're getting equipment out of storage. They're increasing their spare parts reserves. They're increasing their ability to have just all the logistical background to an overseas military deployment. The more of these big overseas military deployments they have going on at any one time, the better that logistical backbone is going to have to be. So it's going to have to force them on focusing on that. And it's also just going to draw them much more closely into the Middle East. They're going to have now several hundred people somewhere on an airbase in the Middle East, either in Sirlik in Turkey or Amman, Jordan. Those are the two that are being talked about. So you're going to have just that increased military presence on the ground for the airbase. There'll be a frigate there. So that is naturally going to draw Germany now more into the web of alliances and everything that's going on. Not that they've been completely disengaged from that, but it's going to draw them more deeply into that. And that's something, again, that will have long-term consequences, even if tensions start dialing down, if there's not some kind of immediate follow-up to the Paris attacks.
We're really focusing on what's just been happening in the last couple of years. It just makes me think about, really, we're looking at the current stages of a trend that began back in the 90s with the Kosovo War, in a sense, where I think someone who, say, was cryogenically frozen in the mid-90s at the state that Germany was at that time, they're looking at a power that is still extremely conciliatory, they're really concerned about not wanting to send the wrong message. They're contrite about what happened during World War II, those types of things. And the idea of a German military deployment to a country outside, sending military deployments to countries all over the place, this is very antithetical to the German mindset at the time. You take right from that moment, you drop that person in today, and you see German deployments all over the place, all over Africa, in the Horn of Africa, through the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and wow, and Kosovo, and what they did in the Balkans. This is a very different Germany just over the just in a single generation, over maybe a 20-year period.
Yes, absolutely, and I think Kosovo, as you said, a big, important milestone, as we mentioned as well, Afghanistan. But I do think there is still a further increased pace from the last couple of years, dating back from January 2014. because Mr. Flurry had an article that that talked about a very significant series of pronouncements, mostly at the Munich Security Conference, from Germany's top leaders that occurred in January 2014. And I can't remember whether it was our cover article or not, but it was certainly one of the articles from our editor, and a very major one, that talked about this, the new rhetoric coming from Germany that was really announced there in January 2014. And here's just a quick quote from the German president, Joachim Gauck. Back then, he asked, are we doing what we can to stabilize our neighborhood, both in the East and in Africa? Are we doing what we have to in order to counter the threat of terrorism? And in cases where we found convincing reasons to join our allies in taking even military action, are we willing to bear our fair share of the risks? What role do we want to play in the crises affecting distant parts in the globe? And he said, in my opinion, Germany should make a more substantial contribution. It should make it earlier and more decisively if it is to be a good partner. And we drew a lot of attention to those comments and comments like that. And now we're really seeing that follow through. That one paragraph describes exactly what we're seeing in Syria. And Joachim Gauck went on to talk about how Germany is hid behind its kind of post-war guilt and use that as an excuse for not getting more involved in the world, to kind of paraphrase his sentiments. You know, he said there are people who use Germany's guilt for its past as a shield for laziness or a desire to disengage from the world. So we're really seeing now them follow through on that. And they have followed through on that over the last couple of years. There has been this very dramatically increased pace of engagements in Africa. They've usually been small ones, maybe 50, maybe just a few hundred. But Germany has been more willing to get involved. And now we've had the first huge or really big type of crisis since then. And we see a Germany that's much, much quicker now to send in a significant contribution. So we're seeing a ramping up of a trend that has gone back a couple of decades, but an intensification of that in the last few years.
And I'm sure it's going to increase all the more, especially once the next crisis rolls around. Well, thank you. We're talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's writing an article on this subject. Watch for it in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Richard, for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Is your heart older than you are? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have issued a report estimating that 3 out of 4 American adults have a predicted heart age older than their chronological age, putting them at greater risk for heart disease. And this is a really interesting way of looking at your heart health. I have nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian here via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
Well, the same.
So tell us about this study. What have they found here?
Well, I'd like to begin by framing it. So if you're the type of person that's going to get up out of bed eager to knock down the dominoes each morning, if you've got lots of energy, then probably this study doesn't apply to you. But for the others, the research states that your heart may be functionally older than your real chronological age. So this was a really interesting study. It's a little sobering when you look at the statistics, but I had some fun with the study itself. Various news outlets quoted the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which released this study on September 2nd, and they estimated, and get this, that 3 out of 4 adults in the United States have a predicted functional heart age older than their chronological age. So just to get a little context, that's about 69 million U.S. adults between the ages of 30 and 74. And to further that context, that's about the number of people living in the 130 largest U.S. cities combined. And they're at risk. So that's no small number. Now, what type of risk are we talking about? There's nearly 800,000 Americans that die of heart-related conditions each year. And their illnesses cost about $320 billion annually. according to the American Heart Association. So what is heart age? Heart age is the age of your heart and blood vessels as a result of your risk factors. So if you smoke or if you have high blood pressure, if your heart age is going to be much higher than your actual age.
In other words, you're 35 years old, but because you smoke or you've got early onset diabetes, something like that, it's like you're walking around with a 45-year-old's heart.
Yes. Yes. So the risk factors are pretty clear. High blood pressure would be a big risk factor. High cholesterol. If you have diabetes, of course, smoking is a huge one. And my two that I always get back to with clients is unhealthy diet and physical inactivity. And as well, which is one of the biggest problems facing North America today, obesity, having an unmanageable body weight. And the more of a risk profile you have, it's said that the older your heart age is. And that doesn't mean that people have to be discouraged by that. It simply means that they need to change their habits.
Right. This report that I read about this, it said specifically that you can actually lower your heart age. You can take steps that I guess, reverse that trend if your heart is aging faster than it should. So that's definitely something that's encouraging. It seems to me like that's actually kind of what they were going for here, is trying to frame this discussion of heart health in a way that would give people a certain amount of a wake-up call to do something different.
Well, it's, you know, this is really interesting because the way that they used to give the risk factors for people is to say, well, you have 10 or 20% chance of heart disease in so many years, or you have so many years before, a heart attack or heart disease. And this concept, when we look at it, we say, well, it was developed. And why was it developed? Well, interestingly, it was developed by experts who worked on called the Framingham Heart Study. And that's an ongoing cardiovascular study, which began in 1948 and is now in a third generation of participants. And what they're trying to do right now is just give people a less ambiguous way to look at their heart age and to change. So if you say, look, you've got a 10% chance of heart disease, you might say, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I'll take that. 90% chance of not having heart disease.
Exactly. Well, who isn't going to say that? But doctors will say, no, that's unacceptable. We don't accept that. But if we tell you, and this is where this concept comes in very nice, if we say, look, your heart age is 10 years older than your chronological age. So if you're 55 and you have a heart age of 65, they found that they can actually get people to respond to that. And that's, they actually had a clinical trial in Europe where they told people their heart age. And these people improved their heart health much more than people who were told their absolute risk of cardiovascular disease. Because in that trial, when they learned their heart age, they were able to reduce it by 1.5 years over the course of 1 year, compared with a reduction of only 0.3 years for those who were given the traditional risk information. So that was very interesting. So when you understand the concept, it helps you to frame the risk better, and then it leads to an action and with a better viable outcome. So if you understand what the risk is, you're more liable to make a change.
So this study actually showed that, what was the average, they say 3 out of 4 adults had a predicted heart age older than their chronological age. What was the average in terms of the gap between those two?
Right. So the highest heart age, well, the gap, it showed, well, 2 in 5 women have a heart age that's 5 or more years older than their chronological age. And for adult men, it was 8 years older than their actual age.
2 out of 5 adult men? Or just
so two in five women have a heart age that's 5 or more years older than their chronological age. And the average cardiovascular age for adult men was 8 years older
Wow.
than their actual age.
That's pretty terrible.
Well, it is because, well, think of it this way. When you think about how much your heart beats and works every year, that's a lot of work and a lot of stress. And if you multiply that by 7 years, that's a lot of output. So if you're an athlete, your heart age is going to be much less than, say, a sedentary person, because you have a strong heart that beats very strongly and your blood pressure is nice and even. And somebody who's sedentary, they're going to have all kinds of problems. So you're just looking at a heart on the reverse ends of the spectrum.
So you're saying if you're over age 30 and you're a male, your heart, if you're average, your heart is 8 years older than you are.
That's what the studies say, yes. And that's what was so interesting. And for women, it's a little less. For men, it's more. I'm not sure what they determined that on, but that's what the statistics say. Interestingly, they say an older heart was seen across all racial and ethnic groups in the U.S., but it was highest among African Americans. And they say those who are more affluent, they have a lower heart age. So I'm not sure if that has to do with poverty and being able to eat better. Mm-hmm. I would suspect that had a big, a lot to do with that, being able to have more healthy foods rather than eating out refined foods. When we look at people coming through our clinic here, I mean, the problems that we encounter always comes down to two, well, not always, in large part comes down to two big factors, not exercising enough and not eating good food. Refined food is, you're dealing with chemicals, additives, steroids, you're dealing with unhealthy fats, sugars, and all of those have a big impact on the body. And many people just never factor that in. They just don't read their labels. If you don't read labels, that has a lot to do with impacting your heart as well. And then, of course, if you're sitting on the couch coming home, you're tired from work, you're sitting there 8 hours looking at a computer screen, and then you come home and you sit another 6 hours in front of the TV, well, your body's not doing much. Mm-hmm. You're not pumping a lot of blood. I mean, you're surviving, but you're not thriving.
So this is basically, when you talk about what you do to lower your heart age, you mentioned people who over the course of a year were actually able to dial backward a year and a half, basically like 2.5 years of youthfulness. These are the factors that you would look at first. Stop smoking, look at your diet, and start getting active.
Well, the physical inactivity, they call for 150 minutes every week of moderate intensity exercise, such as, say, brisk walking. I would call for more than that. I mean, that would be the minimum for me. But again, walking leads to movement, and eat a healthier diet, low in unhealthy fats and salts, more vegetables, of course. Maintain a healthy body weight. That's huge. Smoking is never on anyone's list. I mean, that's just a death sentence. Diabetes, you have to control. So you have to have help with that. Cholesterol has a lot to do with your dietary intake, of course. And high blood pressure, hand in hand. Get control of those goals. Make sure that the big seven factors that I just mentioned, those are the prescription for a younger heart.
So if somebody is interested in actually getting a little more information about the age of their heart, this organization that you talked about, Farmingham study, they have an online calculator that you can go to. And so how do they calculate that? How do you find out based on that what your heart health would be?
Right. So that study is on farminghamheartstudy.org. And they have a nifty little calculator there. It's called a heart age predictor using your BMI, body mass index. And you would punch in male or female, how old you are. You would have to know your systolic blood pressure, and you could get that from your doctor. They would ask you several questions, including, are you being treated for hypertension? Are you a smoker? Are you diabetic? And then the last one would be, what is your body mass index? And the body mass index, again, can be measured by your doctor. Or they actually have some nice devices on the market right now, scales that you can step on to get that. Now, calculating that, it gives you your vascular age with a 10-year risk. And, you know, and this is a great, great little tool for people who are inactive. However, again, we want to frame that because if you're inactive, if you're active, I'm sorry, body mass index is a considered a healthiness of weight. But if you're short or tall, if you're muscular, if you're an athlete, that body mass index is not going to work. It does not account for non-average muscle density, muscle size, or frame size.
Well, that's a pretty big deviation factor there.
Well, it's true because if you have somebody that works out with weights four times a week, that person is going to have a lot of lean muscle on them, and so their body fat might be low. You might sit at, say, 13 or 14% body fat. But the body mass index does not understand how to measure that because it's just a set of questions. So your body mass index will probably show that you're obese. It does with me. It's the opposite end of the spectrum. It does mean no use. But if I take my body fat, it shows it correctly.
Yeah, just so our radio listeners are aware, Jörg Mardian is not obese by any measure, except BMI, apparently. So, well, that's very interesting. We've been talking with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about this study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he, thankfully, has graciously agreed to write up an article about this for thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link in that article to this online calculator if you're interested in finding out your own cardiovascular age. So we look forward to reading that. You can find that article on thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Jörg, for your time.
It's my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Pop music grabs your ear. It draws you in. The catchy tune, the enchanting vocal, the clever lyric, the sweet beat. The radio is full of these songs crafted to captivate you and stick in your mind. And now here you are humming along to that mesmerizing hook. But what are these rich, glamorous people singing about? Have you looked at the lyrics of the top pop songs? Pick any hit, read the words, and you quickly see just how stupid it is, or how vulgar, or self-indulgent and vain, or immoral and perverse, or dangerous and sick. I'm going to read you some of these lyrics, and I'm probably going to sound pretty silly doing so. Gotta kiss myself. I'm so pretty. I'm too hot, sings Bruno Mars in Uptown Funk. This song basically celebrates the singer's own awesomeness and the glamour of lascivious city life. If you sexy, then flaunt it. If you freaky, then own it. Don't brag about it. Come show me. This is a theme in a lot of these songs. Don't hold back. Just be as crazy as you want. Girls, hit your hallelujah, because Uptown Funk gonna give it to ya. I have no idea what that's talking about. This was the biggest song for most of 2015. It might have been the most uplifting, quote unquote, of the handful of hits that I looked at. Every one of them was terrible, gross, lustful, boastful, angry, depressing, brutal, violent, disgusting, nasty. Far worse than I expected. Sampling these lyrics requires skipping over most of them because they're so explicit and profane, if they make any sense at all. So many of these songs celebrate the shallowest, basest lusts. Drake in Hotline Bling sings, "Call me on my cell phone late night when you need my love. I know that when that hotline bling, that can mean only one thing." In a song called 679, Fetty Wap sings, "I'm like, yeah, she's fine. Wonder when she'll be mine. She walked past like press rewind to see that blank one more time. And I got this sewed up." There's a song called X's and O's by L. King. These are just the top 10 songs right now. It says, I had a summer lover down in New Orleans, kept him warm in the winter, left him frozen in the spring. My, my, how the seasons go by. Taylor Swift sings of a doomed affair in Wildest Dreams. Nothing lasts forever, but this is going to take me down. He's so tall and handsome as blank. He's so bad, but he does it so well. I can see the end as it begins. She says, someday when you leave me, I bet these memories hunt you around. So that's the theme in so many of these, anthems of immorality. And unsurprisingly, equally popular are the ballads of the brokenhearted. Adele's newest hit, Hello, says, at least I can say I've tried to tell you I'm sorry for breaking your heart, but it don't matter. It clearly doesn't tear you apart anymore. She's sorry that he's not more brokenhearted over her dumping him. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. A song named Stitches by Shawn Mendes says, I thought that I've been hurt before, but no one's ever left me quite this sore. Your words cut deeper than a knife. You watch me bleed until I can't breathe. I'm shaking, falling onto my knees, and now that I'm without your kisses, I'll be needing stitches. These fools followed their hearts into disastrous relationships, and pathetic fans are now grooving on their depressing confessions. Do you really want to absorb yourself in that miserable world? The Country Music Awards 2014 Song of the Year was Kacey Musgraves' Follow Your Arrow. What's this catchy little number teaching? Well, she says, since people are going to criticize you no matter what you do, you might as well just do whatever you want. So make lots of noise, kiss lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls if that's something you're into. When the straight and narrow gets a little too straight, roll up a joint, or don't. I would. Just follow your arrow wherever it points. Billboard writer Julie Height described the song as a toast to conformity bucking, pot smoking, and same-sex affection. This exercise in absurdity could go on and on, but are you listening to these songs? Take a breath of fresh air and note this up-to-date wisdom from Solomon in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 5. He said, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. You hear the song of fools everywhere today. Lang's commentary says this refers to the extravagant, boisterous, and immoral songs that are heard in the riotous carousals of foolish men. The song of fools fills the airwaves, and everything about it engages the carnal mind. It has instant appeal, like sugar on the tongue, but like refined sugar, its messages are incredibly toxic, and it affects you more than you realize. The peddlers of these songs are attractive, or certainly fascinating, even in bizarre ways, but this is the seduction of the strange woman of Proverbs 5 and Proverbs 7. They often live debauched lives. Their views are twisted. Their morals are sick. The most popular of them openly advocate rank materialism, illegal drug use, sexual license, perversion. They're miserable, and a lot of times they're proud of being miserable. And yet, millions of people listen and watch and hum along and absorb and allow these pop stars to shape their thinking. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17 tells us, come out of the world and be separate. Hear the rebuke of the wise. It's so much better than getting caught humming the song of fools. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of The Trumpet Magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talked about on the program today, and where you can also go to get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Richard Palmer, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Baltasar Gracian. First, be master over yourself if you would be master over others. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.